laser pointer? Come on. A group of programmers and no one's got a laser pointer? Someone must have a laser. Yes. All right, how's that? Okay. I'm gonna get started here. You wanna turn that down a little bit? Okay, I'm really loud. Here's a version of this joke for people who are over 30 years old. Ba-dum-bum. Okay, so I'm gonna spend most of my time on four physics simulators, and then I'm gonna talk a little bit about a fifth physics simulator, which has yet to be written, which I think is kind of an interesting direction to go from lessons learned from these four. So let's get started. How many people here plan on going to the keynote at 12:45? Raise your hand. All right, so I'll attempt to be on time. I was thinking if no one raised their hand, I'd just do an hour and a half talk. All right, prerequisites. So first and most importantly, you have to be comfortable with math. That doesn't mean there's going to be a ton of equations, and I'm going to make you solve them and then quiz you later. But it means that this entire talk and all of physics actually is about using math to model behavior. And so it's really important that you be comfortable with that and not get scared away by a few equations or concepts like that. It'd be really helpful if you understand the difference between kinematics and dynamics. In one sentence, kinematics is position, velocity, time, position and its derivatives with respect to time without any notion of why those derivatives are changing. So things are moving around, they're just animating. Dynamics speaks to the problem of why are these kinematic quantities changing? So force causes acceleration to change, things like that. Inertia causes it to change in a different way, et cetera. It would be very helpful, you'll get a lot more out of the talk, if you're familiar with rigid body dynamics specifically. And you're the ultimate connoisseur of this talk if you have written a physics simulator and run into a bunch of the problems I'm going to talk about or have at least read a whole bunch about physics simulators. On that note, our new thing at the GDC is all about concrete takeaways, so I'm going to outline what I expect you guys to take away from this talk, and then you can cream me in the review if you don't actually take this away. So the whole goal here is to understand the pros and cons of these four different physics simulators and some of the subtleties involved. They're all useful. I'm not going to say, here is the best physics simulator, never go home and type it in. They're all useful, and they all have trade-offs. Kind of as a side note, or a very important thing that you're going to take away that is not contained in any one of the simulators but kind of crosses all of the simulators is these two key concepts. One is degrees of freedom or configuration space and how that's used in math to model problems. And the second is stiffness in physical systems and why I think stiffness is the most important thing that a game physics engine has to deal with these days. And it's all too often not handled correctly, or at all, even. All of my examples and my code is all in 2D, but it pretty much generalizes to 3D pretty directly. Some things get a little more complicated, and the matrices get bigger. This is not going to be a detailed physics tutorial. You will not come out of here knowing how to write any of these four simulators. Hopefully, you will come out of here knowing that if you go and read the papers to write these four simulators, you'll be better off than if you had not seen the talk, and you'll know what to look out for. A couple other related talks that you might be interested in. David Wu is doing a talk on mixing kinematics and dynamics on Saturday. That's really important if you're trying to avoid the insanity of doing a complete physics simulator from the ground up and not having any like hand-done animation. So he's talking about the interaction, which is always complicated, of how you integrate artist-animated stuff and a physically simulated world. The experimental gameplay workshop on Friday is totally cool. It's related to this talk in the sense that only in the sense that I'm going to be demoing my rock climbing game there. But it's also like the coolest thing in the world, even ignoring that. And in fact, in spite of the fact that I'm demoing my rock climbing game, it's still the coolest thing in the world. All right. So, how many people here saw my CCD talk last year? My talk on IK last year. Okay. So last year I did a talk on the first thing I tried for doing my rock climbing game. And that was called cyclic coordinate descent, and it's an IK method. And I'm just going to show it to you really quick because pictures are worth 1,000 triangles. Okay, so this is, come on, there we go. So this is a 2D figure, and you can move them around, right? And this is using IK only. There's no physics here, and I wanted to show you a couple different things that are outlined on this slide, or this slide. First, it's got some non-physical movement. Second, it doesn't support closed loops, so you can't hold on to more than one point at a time. And the third, which you can't see from this demo, is there's no clear path to adding musculature controls to it. So first off, you can see if I do some things like this, he stands up, which makes absolutely no physical sense whatsoever. It's just a way the IK solver searches through the configuration space. Second, I can drag away from the holds here and on the red and the blue holds over here, and the solver, because it doesn't handle closed loops, can't do anything about that. It can try and keep him back there, but it can't do it. And third, the IK system is really geared towards finding any configuration that finds that satisfies some of the constraints. And so it doesn't have a real way of adding in any kind of musculature, which I really needed. So I decided to bail, which is ironic because the entire reason I started doing this rock climbing game was to do a non-physics-based game. But, so I ended up writing 4 simulators, which is like 4 times as much physics as I had written before. Okay, so what I decided to do, because of the problems that I was having with CCD, was to do rigid bodies with constraints. So I figured that would immediately give me the kind of least squares-y physical movement that you intuitively expect when you see something moving around. I don't need to do contact or anything like that, because I'm not stacking boxes or any of those problems. But I need to simulate enough to make it a fully articulated figure in 2D. I also decided to punt on second-order acceleration-based dynamics and go with just first-order dynamics, because if you've ever seen anyone rock climb or any human actually moving normally, they're highly damped. Like, I don't swing back and forth like a pendulum as I try and get into position. I just, like, go to where I want to be. So you could do that with acceleration-based dynamics and then damping the hell out of it, or I can just punt and just have a first-order world, which means that there's no inertia, meaning there's mass, but if I go like this and I'm not exerting a force anymore, things stop moving. Another constraint is I decided I was going to attach the mouse to the climber, because my game is about direct interaction with the climber's body, with a Springer constraint, and that has to be very tight. I want it to be, you click and move, and it looks at it as tight as the CCD was in terms of following the mouse, which I'll show another demo of in a minute. And I wanted the hands and feet to be rigidly attached, if possible, to the wall, so you couldn't pull them off the wall like you could see in the other thing. So I tried 4 different techniques. And you can see they kind of like organize in terms of how they deal with degrees of freedom and how they deal with integration. And I'm going to talk about each of these 4 techniques in more detail later, and I'm going to talk about the 2 sides of this slash mark here and how they differ. So I'm not even going to bother saying them. But I will show you a cool little demo, which has all 4 running at the same time, which is really just an artifact of the fact that I was continually having to fix everything. But I got them all running in the same thing, which actually makes for like an amazing debugging situation. So here are all 4 simulators running at the same time on just like a loose guy. And you can kind of see, you can't really see that they're different, but if I start jerking it around a lot, you can see that they kind of diverge. And you can see what percentage of the time they're using up there and whatever. So it's really useful to be able to check one simulator versus the other. These are 4 simulators using completely different algorithms. And so you know, it's kind of like the XP thing of like write it twice in two different ways so you can test the, so you can make sure that you didn't make the same mistake twice. Okay. So there's these two obvious axes of the techniques that they kind of a decomposition of the technique space. The first is how you represent the coordinates of the human, of the model. And the names of these two techniques are, as in all things math and physics, there are like 15 different names with all the same thing. But augmented versus generalized coordinates are kind of the two common ways of saying this. And we're going to talk about what degrees of freedom mean, so I'm not going to go into it any more than to say this right now. And then the second axis is explicit versus implicit integration. And those are ways of stepping those degrees of freedom forward in time. So you've got the set of degrees of freedom you're representing some way, and then you want to move them forward in time so that you get animation out of it. But first, let's go into the coordinate systems and the degrees of freedom. So augmented coordinates are also called Lagrange multipliers or constraint-based methods. And the idea here is that you simulate all the bodies independently, and then you run this big solve to try and figure out what the constraint forces are need to be on those bodies to keep them constrained the way you want them. So in this little example here, if you think of these as two 2D rigid bodies, so each has 3 degrees of freedom, right? It's got a position on the slide and an orientation on the slide. So the two of those together, simulating them totally separate, have 6 degrees of freedom. But now I want to make sure they're constrained together at this little joint here, so it acts something like, so it acts like this. Right, so it's a little jointed guy and I can move him around. So I want to constrain these two points together, which I end up calculating a constraint force, which I called F right here. I don't know if you can see that. Should we dim the lights at all, or is it okay? No? It's fine. You want to dim them? Well, then, okay, dim them. I can't do it from up here. In order to keep this point on this body connected to this point on this body, here at the tip of this little arm here, I have to compute a force, right? So in other words, if this body starts translating that way, some force here has to keep this point on this body there so that it drags it along with it, right? And that force is since it's a 2D vector, it's a 2 degree of freedom force. And so, hey, if I subtract those two, if I'm computing that and then adding that force back in, that subtracts 2 degrees of freedom from my system and I end up with a Fordoff system, okay? Now, if you think about that, that makes a lot of sense because, hey, I've got a single rigid body in 2D, which has 3 degrees of freedom, and I add another rigid body, but its position is fully specified by the angle of this, which only adds 1 more degree of freedom, which happens to be what generalized coordinates are. So instead of simulating all the rigid bodies and then all of the constraint forces to bring it back down to the degrees of freedom that you actually want to be active, generalized coordinates figures out what the actual degrees of freedom are that you really want to simulate. So a bunch of other names for this are reduced coordinates, embedded methods, recursive methods. I mean, there's a whole bunch of names. Generalized coordinates is pretty much common. It's more common than augmented coordinates for the other one. Usually you'll see Lagrange multipliers. And so you calculate and simulate only the degrees of freedom of the system that actually matter, that are not constrained. So in this case, I simulate one of these bodies. It doesn't matter which. It's totally symmetric. I simulate one of these bodies, and then the joint angle is the other degree of freedom in my system. So I have to write, unlike augmented coordinates, where I can simulate the two separately and I kind of understand it's each one of them is just a rigid body, this is something that's not a rigid body anymore. In other words, this thing behaves in a different way than a single rigid body. So I have to write different equations for it. Okay. So let's take a brief segue into degrees of freedom, because I think that I actually think degrees of freedom is the most important thing in math, the concept of degrees of freedom. And that's totally biased by the way I've learned math, but I think it's really cool and it's incredibly important and helps you model everything when you start thinking about this way. To understand any mathematical system, in some sense, all you need to do is find out what its degrees of freedom are. And so what is a degree of freedom? I mean, we are always talking about, oh, it's got 6 degrees of freedom or it's got whatever, and what does that really mean? Well, what that means in a kind of more formal way, this is a very informal definition, but a degree of freedom is that all the degrees of freedom of a system are the coordinates necessary and sufficient to reach every valid state. They're necessary, meaning there can't be, if I've got the degrees of freedom picked correctly, there can't be states that I can get to, I guess that's sufficient. There can't be states I can get to that I can't get to by joinking with the degrees of freedom. And the converse is also true. If given a state, or given some degrees of freedom, they will reach all possible states by joinking them. So here's some examples. A point in 2D has 2 degrees of freedom, right? It's got its x and its y coordinate. Boom. Those are two degrees of freedom. Every degree of freedom is a scalar. A point in 3D has 3 degrees of freedom. It's got, you know, x, y, and z. A 2D rigid body, as we already talked about, has 3 degrees of freedom, and a 3D rigid body has 6 degrees of freedom. So there's an interesting thing here, and this is why 3D is hard, because angles went from scalars to needing three components. It's not a vector, but to needing three components in 3D. And that's why a quaternions and all, we have to do all of these things, it's because there's this weird discontinuity leap there. A point on a line has 1 degree of freedom because it can only move back and forth on the line, as we'll show in a little example here. A point on a plane has 2 degrees of freedom. I mean, this is a plane. Any two manifold in the space is a plane. So take a real-world example of like a simple desk lamp that's bolted down to the table. Ignoring the head, it's got 3 degrees of freedom, right? It can rotate around, and then it can change the arm. If you count the head, which has, you know, 2 rotational degrees of freedom, hey, you have a 5 degree of freedom system. And you can kind of go around and like count degrees of freedom in systems. Like this microphone stand has a lot of degrees of freedom because it's got so many little joints along here. A continuous body has an infinite number of degrees of freedom, but you can make approximations. Like say I decide to use quadratic deformation. Oh, then I get 3 degrees of freedom per deformation distance, et cetera. But so you can measure these degrees of freedom. That's really annoying. You can measure these degrees of freedom in any system that you choose. I mean, sometimes it's infinite, but you can still like conceptualize what they are. So systems have degrees of freedom, and equations in terms of those degrees of freedom constrain and eliminate degrees of freedom. And there's really the scalar relationship. Every degree of freedom is a scalar, and every scalar equation constrains away, eliminates a scalar degree of freedom. So if you end up writing vector functions, you might have a vector degree of freedom, like say a point in 3D. Hey, that's 3 degrees of freedom because there are 3 scalars that make that up. If I write a cross product constraint on that, a cross product actually constrains away 2 degrees of freedom. So I'm back to a 1 degree of freedom thing. Okay, so here's a little example. I've got a point in 2D, it's got x, y, so it has 2 degrees of freedom. If I constrain it to a line using a constraint equation, say x equals 2y, then I have a 1 degree of freedom system. Now, what is the degree of freedom there? It's not x and it's not y because they're coupled by this constraint equation. So I can insert this other parameter. I can figure out how to parameterize that line in terms of a single degree of freedom, and in that case, it's t, the parametric line equation. So hey, now I doink around t, and it generates all possible x and y's that are valid given that constraint equation. Right? So hey, there's t, it's my degree of freedom. Here was x and y, it was my degree of freedom. I added on a constraint, and I renamed the degree of freedom. I could always solve this line for x or y to give me, in this case here, it's solved for x. But the problem is, hey, how do I do vertical lines then? Whereas I should be able to write any scalar constraint equation, right? Okay, so the configuration space is the space of the degrees of freedom. In this case, it's the plane. In this case, it's the line. The manifold is kind of loosely synonymous with that, but usually you talk about the manifold as being viewed embedded in the space. So we can kind of hear, oh, here's a one manifold embedded in this 2D space. Does that make sense? So being able to find these degrees of freedom and kind of conceptualize them really helps you model problems because you're like, oh, I see, I can eliminate this degree of freedom with this kind of constraint. Oh, I see, this has this, you know, here's how the system really works. Okay, so let's revisit this before moving on to stiffness. So the idea here is that augmented coordinates have the dynamics equations for all of the bodies independently, or all of the systems independently, and then you constrain them together. And what this means is, because the constraint forces are simulated separately, it's kind of in some sense, a more general and modular architecture. It's kind of plug and play, or you can turn them off to break them, for example, by just not applying the force. So you can have, it's kind of like a Tinker Toy set. Oh, I got this body, and I constrain it to this other body, et cetera, et cetera. They result in big and often sparse linear systems when you're solving them. But you are simulating a whole bunch of useless degrees of freedom. For example, if you have a 3-degree of, or a 6-degree of freedom body, like a rigid body in 3D, and you want it to just move along a line and not be able to rotate, you had to constrain away 5 degrees of freedom of your system to get a single 1 degree of freedom system. So you're simulating the 6 degrees of freedom for the rigid body plus the 5 degrees of freedom for the constraint when you only really wanted to simulate a single 1 degree of freedom scalar. So you can see there's a kind of waste there that you're trading off for this kind of plug-and-play modularity. By contrast, generalized coordinates, you only simulate the dynamics equations. The constraints are implicit in the dynamics equations because you've reduced them down to their degrees, the valid degrees of freedom. So I'm going to go back a slide. In this case, if this was a physical system, I would be simulating, my physical system would be simulated on T, not on X and Y in this case, in a generalized coordinates method. So unfortunately, what you get is this like kind of complicated and custom-coded solution because, hey, every time I write a constraint equation, I have to figure out what the real reduced degrees of freedom are. In this example here, if I wasn't smart enough to know that T was the like dumb thing and I had decided to solve for X or Y, and my slope of my line had gone vertical or horizontal, whichever one makes this infinity, I would have had to recompute. I would have been like, okay, my system wouldn't have worked. You need to reparameterize and pick the right degrees of freedom. So that's kind of complicated. It leads to small, dense, nonlinear systems because they're highly coupled. And they also don't support closed loops. Because of the way the constraint and degrees of freedom equations interact, you can't have like a necklace that can pull from both sides, like that's completely connected. You can simulate part of your system with generalized coordinates and part of your system with augmented coordinates to get that, but all the generalized coordinates have to be broken up and have tree structure at best. You also can't have what are called non-holonomic constraints, which is a fancy word for velocity-based constraints. All of the, in this example, going back again, in this example, this is a positional constraint. It's saying X, or the point can only move along this line. But there's nothing in augmented coordinates from stopping us from writing constraint equations on the velocities, saying, hey, X, or this point can only move in this direction twice as slow as it moves in this direction. Or you can really write, you can write situations that can't be integrated up to a positional equation. And generalized coordinates can't solve those problems. You have to be able to write out in position space what the constraint equation is. So sometimes that's not a problem, sometimes that is a problem. So it's just one of the trade-offs here. All right, so we're going to table this until we get back to talking about the various simulators. And we're going to talk about stiffness. So as I said, I think stiffness is the new, what's the old important thing? I don't know, but it's the new one. So any system that is fast-changing tends to be stiff. That's a kind of oversimplification. But take the real world, for example. The real world is insanely stiff. Like, you can drop a steel block on a piece of concrete, and it kind of, like, bounces a little bit and then stops. And, like, the amount of stiffness going on there to make that non... I mean, in the real world, there are no such things as rigid bodies. That's a deformable body, but you didn't see it deform at all because it's so stiff. Its internal forces are so strong relative to the forces that it takes on from the outside that it appears as if it's rigid. So when we move into the virtual world, when we have to have computers like spend flops to solve our systems, we make approximations like rigid body. So what a rigid body is, a rigid body is an approximation that takes the high number of degrees of freedom of a deformable body and then puts a ton of constraint equations on it such that it constrains down to 6 degrees of freedom. And you just assume that all of those constraints are rigid constraints instead of having the body be able to flex. Because it's so hard to simulate the incredibly strong forces and the change in those forces. So I'm going to show you some demos of this, but one place that this comes into games immediately is that UI is incredibly stiff because the player wants responsiveness. So the mouse, I can move the mouse with a flick of my finger across the entire screen. If in world space that happens to be like 10 meters or something, that means in, you know, a millisecond or two, I went from one end of the 10 meters to the other end back just by flicking my mouse a little bit. And whatever my mouse is attached to in the world had to actually change like that in a physically consistent way. So first I'm going to show you back in the CCD demo, because CCD being a kinematic method deals with stiffness trivially. So if you watch this, like, I can jerk this guy around as much as I want, and he's always on the mouse, right? Like, at no point is this guy lagging behind the mouse. That's insanely stiff. You imagine a human moving that fast, like a full-scale human, there's just no way. Like, the forces... Okay, so that movement right there is stiff, incredibly so. Kinematically animating objects can be arbitrarily stiff because I can affect the... I can just change their position discontinuously. And if I'm trying to, like, keep a spring on something and have the thing track that, you have an incredibly stiff system. All right, so what do I mean? I keep using this word stiff, and I haven't really defined it. So before I go on to define it, I'll continue talking about why it's really important. Here's the... You want to handle as much stiffness as you possibly can, because it's easy to go one way, but it's not easy to go the other way. Your designers are going to come into your... So your designers don't care a lick about what, you know, what integrator method you're using and, like, you know, what your time step is and any of those things. They just want to build systems that work. And the systems they're going to initially build invariably will be very stiff because they want that responsiveness. And so what stiffness does is gives designers control. If your system is robust in the face of stiffness, the designers can throw whatever they want at it, and then if they want softer-looking behavior, hey, they just tune it down, because it's easier to go from stiff to soft if you support stiff. It's impossible, almost, to go from soft to stiff. An explicit integrator, which we're going to talk about, I'm going to have some diagrams about what that really means, does not handle stiff systems without an incredibly tiny time step, and the time step scales in the wrong way, like 1/stiffness kind of scaling. Depending on how you define it. So this is back to kind of some books actually use this as a numerical definition of stiffness, as a formal definition. If an explicit integrator cannot integrate this system without tiny time steps that are dependent on the constants in the equation, then the system is stiff. All right, so what the hell am I talking about here? Okay, so we're going to use a little model problem here to talk about what stiffness means. So in this case, we're using exponential decay, which means, this shows up in like a billion different situations in physics, but let's pretend, for example, that the x-axis is time and the y-axis is velocity of some particle or something like that. So this is not a positional graph, this is a velocity space graph, right? So time is passing this way, and because I'm in some viscous medium, my object is slowing down, so velocity decreases over time. So in this system, we got a little exponential decay here, a little spring damper type thing, the damper part of a spring damper. Here's what this looks like charted out. Here's the correct integrated position over time. If my initial velocity was this, my initial y was this point, for some units of time, which are just totally arbitrary in these diagrams, my velocity will decay towards zero, right? Because I'm in a viscous medium, I'm going to slow down. If I multiply that times 10, the viscosity factor times 10, so here we got a viscosity of 1 in the sense that you have imagine a coefficient in front of the y. If I have a viscosity factor of 10, here's what that graph looks like. So in the time it took this guy to slow down from here to here, basically, this thing went to zero. Okay? This is a stiff system because it changes so rapidly. It, like, instantly goes to zero. So there's nothing like a demo. Great color, Chris. Can you see that at all? No. All right, let's pick a different simulator with a better color. Can you see that? Yeah? Okay, so like, you want me to go recompile the app with a different color? Okay, so can you actually see this cube, the little square? Yes, in back? As long as I don't move it. Oh, good. Well, this is going to be a great demo. There you go. Stiffness, ladies and gentlemen. Okay, so Here's what I'm going to do. This is not making any difference, is it? Okay. See him following? Well, here. You can watch the red thing. The red thing is attached to an object. Trust me. So what I'm doing right now is I'm dragging this around with a spring constant. Now, if I decrease the spring constant, it'll get sloppier. All right? See, it's slower to chase me. Okay? Now, if I turn on this is an implicitly integrated system. If I turn an explicit integrator, with this low spring constant, they're exactly on top of each other, right? The reason you can't see the green thing that you couldn't see anyway is because there's a red thing on top of it. So when they diverge, it's going to be really hard for you to tell. Okay. However, and so you've got, if you can read this, like, hey, I've got a KS of negative 0.7 into some whatever random units I'm using, so it means nothing. So if I start to increase that, it starts to get more and more responsive, right? This is way more responsive than this, right? That's really slow and milky and gooey. This, starting to follow the mouse a lot more. But now we're starting to get up into implicit land. And you're going to see, can you see that? Boom. Oh, there went the red one. Because that spring constant is now too stiff for an implicit integrator to follow, and I'll show you exactly why on the next slide. Whoa, unless I alt-tab to it now. And wait, I faulted. Because the other object like shot off into space. All right. But with this object, you can see that I can actually crank this spring constant. I've actually got on the implicit integrator here. This is even harder to see than the other one. On the implicit integrator, I swear there's a cube right there. On the implicit integrator, I've got a scale of 20 times this, so it's actually 60 right now, and you can see it's following the mouse around almost like a kinematic system because I've made it really stiff. And this is the behavior you want if you want this behavior. It's easy for me to go back to a sloppy system from here, but as you saw, the explicit integrators can't cope. Okay, so what does all this mean? Why are these two things doing this? So here's our same model problem. And here's some diagrams about how the two integrators work on this model problem. So I got a little red dot. The red guys are the explicit, and the green guy is the implicit integrator. So what an explicit integrator does, which is if you're not doing relatively high-end physics, you're probably using an explicit integrator in your game right now for lots of things. If you add dt, you know, if you multiply the velocity times dt and add it to your position, that's an explicit integrator. And here's what that does. It takes, as it says right here, it takes the derivative of the current position and leaps forward based on the time step. So in this case, if let's say my time step, here we go. So if this is my time step, right, I'm going to step farther, this much farther in time. I started here at this red dot, and I'm going to step to here. If that's my time step, I measure my velocity there, and I step forward to that point. Now, this is a numerical integration technique, so it's not going to be exact. So, hey, I went off the actual true analytical integrated path. That's okay. I mean, as long as we're not doing something crazy. You can see that if we had decreased our time step, we would have ended up here, which is less off. But you're always going to be a little bit off because it's numerical integration, unless your system is very simple. So, but hey, I'm here, and like I still slowed down. I slowed down a little bit more than I might have if I had a better integrator, a more accurate integrator, but I'm still okay, right? And then, hey, when I measure it here, it's going to go down here, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. However, if my time step was bigger, say, for example, here to here on this red guy, look what happens. I measure, and this is the exact same, this is just time shifted here. So this is the same, well, except for the fact that it is a little bit lower, but whatever. This is just, if I could draw in PowerPoint better, this would just be time shifted. And so this would be the same derivative, but now I'm multiplying it by a bigger time step, and hey, I end up down here. So if this is positive velocity up this direction, and this is negative velocity, my object just reversed direction in a single time step. Because I stepped too far for the spring, the damping coefficient in this system. Does that make sense? Hey, check that out. I'm going to change my talk to a water surface simulation talk, and I'm going to do it totally physically. Okay, so, all right. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. Yes, with authority. Excellent. Okay, so that's an explicit integrator. So let's, before we go to the implicit integrator, and I trip over this thing, let's go over here to the really stiff system. All right, I'm not going over there to the really stiff system. I'm going to stand right here. I measure the velocity here, and hey, the velocity is basically straight down. Because, hey, it's a really stiff system. So regardless of how small my time step is, unless it's incredibly tiny on this system, I'm jumping into negative velocities and my object is reversing directions. That's what happened when you saw that, when I turned the spring constant up high enough in the one square shot off into nowhere land. It shot down here, and then you notice that if this is the distance in positive velocity space, to what our old velocity was, right? So at t0 here, our velocity is 1, say. But hey, the negative velocity of 1 is here. If I end up shooting below that, I'm going to do the same thing and go here, and I'm going to shoot a little bit higher than 1 next time, and a little bit higher, and then a little bit higher, and my object just flies off into nowhere land in a few time steps. Especially in this case, like all I needed to do is get higher than here. Any amount of time step, or you know, even a very small amount of time step is going to land me up here somewhere, down here somewhere, and then shoo, off I go. So how is implicit different? So implicit is a little bit weird, and this is why they're harder to solve. But the implicit integrator looks forward in time to a place that points back to where I currently am. Which sounds really weird, but if you look at the diagram, it kind of makes a lot of sense. It says, I want to step forward by a certain amount. Every one of these gray lines, I mean, there's an infinity of them. Every one of these gray lines is a solution to some system that of the same equations, right? It's just time offset. The implicit integrator looks forward at t1 for some solution to the equations that points back. Notice the slope here points back to where we were. We're not at all paying attention to the slope where we started. We're paying attention to the slope at the end. Same here, I want to take a longer time step. Well, it searches farther down the thing and finds something that points back to me. Now, because you need the time in the future to know this, you have to solve a system. Whereas this is just, hey, blindly measure the derivative and leap ahead. So, but you see how that works on a stiff system. Hey, I want to go this far. Well, that just means it ends up looking for something it ends up looking for something at that time distance that points back towards where we are. And hey, that's going to be a pretty shallow thing. But hey, we ended up at zero almost. And then the next time step, we're certainly going to be at zero. And which is the correct solution to this equation? It's totally inaccurate. Like we should have been at zero here, not almost zero here. But it was stable. This just like shot to zero exactly right, whereas this guy shot off into infinity. And that's the key thing. The implicit integrator is no more accurate, but it's arbitrarily more stable in the face of stiffness. So you can see why the implicit integrator can handle both. So I can always step back to this if I want a goopy world, but I have to use an implicit integrator if I want a stiff world. All right. So now we're going to go into each one in a little bit more detail, one slide per, until we get to the final one that I'm actually using, and I'm going to talk about that in a little more detail. And then I'll have a slide on the mysterious fifth simulator. Okay. So I'm just like using notation here that's like, hey, I'm not going to write the entire thing out. So this is the augmented coordinates and the explicit integration, otherwise known as Lagrange multipliers. This is my ponytail article from a few years back, is basically this. You form the dynamics equations for the bodies. You form the constraint equations, you know, you figure out what you want constrained to what. You solve for the constraint forces, apply those back to the bodies as if they were any other forces, gravity, you know, wind, springs, whatever. You integrate the bodies forward in time using usually some kind of run-cut explicit integrator. And hey, you've got new body positions. Because the integration step is explicit, you can't handle stiffness without tiny time steps. So the pros here are it's simple, modular, and general, right? You write this thing once, you can easily write a tool that allows you to nail things to other things and constrain things to the world, and you can make bridges and all kinds of cool things that you see in all these physics simulator demos that everybody does. The downside is it's got medium-sized matrices, but hey, computers are fast. It's got some drift inherent in the fact that applying the constraint forces, solving the constraint forces and applying to the bodies as a separate step leads to numerical inaccuracy, so things kind of drift apart, but you can easily correct for those problems. But the biggest problem is it doesn't handle stiff systems. So there's a ton of references for these, like Barath. My favorite constraint dynamics book is a book by Shabana. These books are all referenced on my website, so you don't have to write them down now. The original, why am I chewing ice when I've got a microphone? The original, totally dumb. The original paper by Barzel and Barr and Sigraf in like 84 or whatever on constrained like animation was about Lagrange multipliers, et cetera. So they're pretty well known. It's fairly easy to implement if you know a little bit of linear algebra. And it works pretty well for getting your first simulator up and running. But the stiffness problem is, if you want to put it in a real game, is going to kill you. So hey, why not go to augmented coordinates and implicit integration? So I tried that next. So in this case, you still form the dynamics equations for the augmented system. And then I chose, because Lagrange multiplier style constraints are hard to do implicitly, I chose to use really stiff springs. Because once you've got an implicit integrator, there's no reason not to use springs because you can make them really, really stiff so they approach constraints. I use an implicit integrator to solve for the next state, which does the constraints and the next state at the same time implicitly, so hey, you can have stiffness. I use an integrator that's built into, an integrator that Champagne wrote for MATLAB called ODE23S, which is a pretty fast, small, adaptive time-step integrator, or you can also turn it on semi-implicit integration, or semi-implicit Euler, which is like the common thing to do. And I'm going to talk more about this adaptive time-step thing in a minute. And this works pretty well. One thing I want to mention here with this concept of you can use, the implicit integrators almost always have a matrix solve in them, in the integrator. An RK integrator, explicit integrator, does not. But if you want to do constraints, you had to have a linear system solver to calculate the constraint forces. So it's kind of a question of, hey, where do you want your linear solver? Do you want it in your constraint force calculation, or do you want it inside your integrator? And you can kind of choose where to put it, or put it in both in some weird senses when you kind of start to glom these things together. So you get this kind of like conservation of linear system solved weird thing that happens. So, hey, this is simple modular because it's like augmented in general, but it also handles stiff systems. It's inexact because everything's held together with springs. You can make them very stiff, but it's inexact. They're very, very big matrices now because it's matrices in the augmented, it's matrices in the number of constraint forces, right? So if you've got a zillion constraint forces, you get this really big matrix. So you get like a matrix proportional to the number of bodies and the number of constraint forces or something. I'd have to look up exactly how it works. And more importantly, because it's an implicit integrator, it needs derivatives. These matrices are often sparse, as we talked about before, but it needs derivatives of the forces, like all implicit integrators will, which starts to get to be a pain. But you're not going to avoid that with implicit integration. It's just a thing you're going to need to know. So, for example, Barath's cloth stuff works kind of like this. It's not a spring system, but it's got a big implicit integration solve. And there's some other stuff. Jeff Lander has talked about solving spring systems and that sort of thing. Okay. So next, I implemented this and I was happy with the I implemented this one and I was happy with the stiffness part when I realized that stiffness was going to be the key thing after implementing. So I implemented first the Lagrange multipliers thing because that's what I knew. And then I realized quickly that stiffness was going to kill me in this game because I have a UI attached to the character, the mouse attached to the character. So then I implemented this augmented implicit one, and I was doing great except for the fact that in order for it to be accurate, I had to use this ODE23S adaptive time-step integrator, and that's slow because what it'll do is, because it's an adaptive time-step, it'll grind down as accurate as it needs to get in order to solve the system correctly. Even if you set its accuracy down, in order to follow the stiffness, it has to sometimes grind the time-step down, and it would jerk around a lot. So I was like, okay, I'm going to have to switch away from these huge systems so that I can afford to run the integrator more. So the first thing I did was switch to an explicit system so I could learn how to do generalized coordinates, which I had never done before. So in this case, this is usually the explicit generalized coordinate integrators that you are system physics simulators that you see. Use what's called the composite rigid body method. Because you have this problem when you're doing generalized coordinates of how you formulate that system, the coupled highly nonlinear system. And so there's all these recursive methods that are kind of O-N that will formulate these matrices for you by doing this recursive tree hierarchy walk out and then an outward and an inward iteration. And so a really good one is called the composite rigid body method. It's pretty easy to implement, and it creates this matrix for you that you then solve AX equals B on. And it incrementally does it, so you can kind of, it's not as handy as Lagrange multipliers. In other words, Lagrange multiplier situation, augmented situation, the bodies don't even know they're constrained to each other. Here, you actually have to form this tree structure hierarchy and walk it. So there is more coupling, and it's not quite as general, but hey, you get this much smaller matrix. And then you integrate the state forward just like a normal forward explicit system. So I use an RK, the same RK as I used for the augmented Lagrange multiplier. So the pros are I get a small matrix, and the joints are explicit, which is the pro and the con. It's like a contrast to the small general system, or to the kind of plug-and-play thing. The cons are this matrix is totally dense in general, so you have to use a Gaussian, like a full dense matrix solver. You don't necessarily have to Gaussian eliminate it, but you get this dense matrix. You can't take advantage of sparsity. You get an n-cube system, basically. And it's not stiff because, hey, I'm using an explicit integrator. And it's not modular. But I knew I wanted to do this go towards the next slide. So this is the traditional way of solving generalized coordinate systems. Like Featherstone has a book about it that's pretty famous, and you can get some stuff online. But here's what I really wanted to do, because I knew I needed implicit, and I think I thought I needed generalized coordinates to reduce my coordinate space so that I could simulate it faster. And I also talked to David Wu, who's smarter than me about this stuff. Okay, so here's what you do. It's a generalized coordinate system solver with an implicit integrator shoved into it. This is basically four slides that encapsulate Dave Wu's talk from last year in some sense. I'm doing it in a slightly different way, but pretty much the same thing. You form your generalized coordinate dynamics. And then because it's an implicit integrator, you have to differentiate those, which I choose to do analytically, and I write it all out on a big piece of paper, and then I like type it in and like hope it works, and then test it. Dave uses something called automatic differentiation, where he wrote a parser for his C code that would then differentiate it, which is you can actually download packages that do this. Because the generalized coordinate systems are highly nonlinear, it's better to use a fully implicit Euler solver for them. So you differentiate and then you solve this entire system with a nonlinear equation solver. And I'm going to show in detail how that works, or in some detail on the next slide. So you solve it for the new state and off you go. So you've got pretty small matrices, explicit joints, and it handles stiffness. So it's a huge performance win. The downside is it's dense and not very modular, and it's kind of a mess, and it needs these derivatives, which are just a real pain to compute. So I mean, you've got all the normal trade-offs of, hey, I can do this, I can type all this in myself, and it might have bugs, and it's hard to change. I can use automatic differentiation, which means that like I have to generate these files that then contain my differentiated functions that I can't go edit. I have to go re-edit this other thing and do a compile step, et cetera, et cetera. So it's just a pain to need derivatives, but you have to support stiffness. So it's just a pain that you have to put up with. Okay, so this is basically a Featherstone solver with a fully implicit Euler step in it, which is what Dave does. So here's how that works. Spit the ice back up. So I have F equals ma, but in my case it's mv because, hey, I'm doing velocity space because I don't care about inertia and acceleration. So there's two things you can do with F equals ma. You can formulate a forward dynamics algorithm, which means, as it says there, and this is what we normally do, given some forces, compute the velocities, right? So I divide by m, and I got the delta t, and I multiply in there, and off we go, and we're stepping forward. If I update my position with this directly from t0, then, hey, I've got an explicit integration scheme. There's another thing you can do, which is a little bit weird, it's kind of conceptually weird, but it's exactly the same. So notice I split f up into the force that is on the joints, not the constraint force in augmented coordinates, but the force on the joints that makes them rotate in generalized coordinates. The force on the joints plus any external forces like gravity, springs, my mouse cursor spring, the whole contact holds, all of those things. So when I'm talking about F in general, like I want to do forward dynamics, I just glom those all together into a single F, and then I divide by M, and off goes my dynamics. I mean, M dividing by M in a generalized coordinate system is solving a matrix problem, right? Dividing by M might mean inverting a matrix or using a Gaussian elimination or something. But conceptually, it's just dividing by M to go from force space to velocity space. But so there's this other way of thinking about it, which is this inverse dynamics way, which is given velocities for my object and the external forces, what would the joint forces have to be for that movement to be consistent with the equations, to be in equilibrium? So, hey, here's where I separated out my external forces from my internal forces. I've got my known, quote-unquote, known velocities here and my known external forces here, and this, by just rearranging this, tells me what my forces on my joints had to have been. So, of course, the question is, how do you know your velocity? Because that's exactly what you're trying to solve for. But, and that's what we're going to get to on the next slide, but the important thing to take away from this is, given any velocity, I can check it for equilibrium. Given any velocity, if I plug it into here, if it equals zero, then I know that the current joint velocities balance out the current external forces. Does that make sense? I mean, if this side of the equation drops to zero, meaning I don't need to exert any more forces on my joints because they're moving at the current velocities, I found an equilibrium point and Newton is satisfied. Newton, F equals MA Newton, not Newton as in Newton-Raphson, which we're also going to use. Newton was prolific. Okay, so I can use this inverse dynamics algorithm to check for validity in equilibrium state given a potential velocity. So what are we going to do with that? Now, it didn't show here, but this force, the force here might depend on the body's position. So it's really this is really a function of position and velocity. So I have F, which I'm just going to call my entire inverse dynamics thing, and it's a function of the positions and the velocities, the state Q. When this is zero, then I know my system is moving correctly. That these velocities are the valid velocities for that position. And hey, I found an equilibrium point. What we want for an implicit integration is we want the solution to be valid at the new time, at Q1. Right? That's if we went back all the way to that slide where on the exponential decay thing, hey, I want to be pointing back towards myself. I want to be valid when I'm done, not when I'm starting. Because I know I can't trust where I'm starting given an arbitrary time step and arbitrary stiffness. So hey, how do I solve something in the future? Well, first off, you have to make a definition of what the future is. In this case, the future, we're going to say, is an implicit first-order Euler step. Okay? So we're going to say, well, I define the future Q1 as the current state plus the time step times the velocity at the end state. That's the part that's saying, in the future, I want to point back towards where I was. Right? Because this is saying, hey, if I get to here, then my derivative at the new position points back towards Q0. I mean, that's exactly what that equation says. Make sense? Okay, so now I'm just going to do a little maneuvering on this and say, hey, I can say, well, here, we'll just skip down to here. I can drop this Q1 into this equation, right? I'm trying to solve for, okay, I'm totally killing your laser pointer here. Since I'm trying to solve for Q1 here, so I've got these two unknowns here. This defines one of them, and I can drop it in here, and now I get an equation in just Q1 dot, or prime, because PowerPoint sucks. So now I have a function in just the velocities. And it's a nonlinear function, and so I can solve that. So I can use what's called a nonlinear equation solver to solve this equation for what the Q1 dots had to have been for my system to reach equilibrium. And then I use those Q1 dots to step forward to my new state. Okay, that's totally abstract, but this is exactly what you're doing. Like, you have some function, you probe it with velocities, you try and find some given velocity, and the way you do that with a nonlinear equation solver is by trying velocities and seeing how they're changing and then moving around in that space. So here's a diagram. So this is a well-known problem, but it's very hard. So I have this function of Q1 dot, which is and Q1 dot is unknown, and I want to solve for Q1 dot. Now, because this is super nonlinear, I can't just like rewrite it with algebra and get Q1 dot equals some closed form thing. I have to solve it numerically. This is a very hard problem, but it's very well documented. There's like hundreds of books about this. So here's an example of why it's hard. Okay. here's a two-degree of freedom system. Like, I've got a constraint to the world here, and which can rotate, and I've got a constraint to this other object here. I have a spring attached to the mouse cursor here. I pull, and the mouse, and I move the mouse. Here's the correct solution. Now, these all correspond to this diagram here is joint angles. This is the joint angle of one of them, probably the root, and this is the joint angle of the other, okay? And because it's a two-degree of freedom system, I can just plot it, so it makes it easy to visualize. Here's where we started. This is this position. This corresponds to this. This corresponds to the correct answer, which I got by integrating with a good integrator that's too slow for games. This is where you end up if you use a first-order Euler step. Hey, we end up with something that's kind of pseudo-plausible, but it doesn't look exactly right, and we're absolutely nowhere near the correct answer. But if this looks good enough, you're kind of okay. I mean, this did find some minimum here. It was not the exact right answer, but it did not blow up. It did not jump off in the middle of nowhere. It found, it ground wrong here and, like, went down this valley and found something. So solving this is an open problem. And there's a couple different trade-offs you can make versus solving it versus minimizing it. But this is still way better than not handling stiffness, even though this is broken. Most of the time, if this was less stiff, this would smooth out into a big, nice bowl, and this guy here would just skip right over to the right answer. As you increase the stiffness, these mountains all start rising in between the position where you start and the position where you're going. And so it's harder and harder for the nonlinear solver to walk around that area and know where to go, because it has no information that it should go this way. Like, there's nothing that says it. In fact, the derivative here says to go this way, which is just obviously totally wrong. This is a really hard problem. So the mysterious fifth simulator, which I want to implement next, so this works pretty well. The current thing works pretty well. I could ship with this. But on slower machines where you can't step as often, things jump around a little bit because it misses and it drags. So this current thing that I just discussed is the current best bet. Dave Wu uses this, and he limits his stiffness. He makes it so that you can't put springs stiffer than his frequency in there for how much he knows he's going to update. But I've got a mouse cursor attached directly to the guy. I need the user, if they want to be able to drag the thing around. Because like, you know they're going to do it. They're going to start clicking on the guy and going like this at the beginning before they start playing the game. So what happens here is the following. I simplify my entire system down to this single unknown, this single nonlinear solve, and then I do tons of wacky subdivision in this space to try and help it walk around to the right place, because there's no telling what the right place is at the time when you're running the code. So you end up doing all this adaptivity, but it's in search space instead of in time, like an adaptive time step integrator. And sometimes it can't work. Like this, it cannot find the solution. There's nothing in the math except for taking an arbitrarily small global search of this space to know that it should have gone over here. I mean, we can see it easily by like plotting the function in Mathematica, but there's nothing in the equation to let it know that because we already simplified by inserting the implicit Euler step into the thing. That's what did it. So here's the new idea. The ODE23S adaptive integrator will find an answer no matter what, because it's actually integrating through time, not searching through state space. But it will be slow. It will grind down on these really stiff parts of the problem as it tries to crawl along the derivative. But hey, I've already got some adaptivity in my other thing anyway that doesn't work. So it seems like a better idea, because the Newton solve will sometimes just not be able to find the answer, no matter how much CPU you wanted to give it, because it can't find it in that nonlinear search space. So it seems to me the new idea is it's better, instead of making more and more wacky subdivision and search schemes in the Newton space where you've already thrown away the information needed to go to the next to find the answer, you really want to make the adaptive time step integrator faster so that it doesn't bog down, so it has some frame rate limitation, so it has some fixed resource allocation that it can do time-wise. Instead of truncating early and then trying to fix it up later, spend your time optimizing the adaptive time step integrator, because at least it then has the information to solve. All right, so that's the end. So it's really hard to simulate an articulated rigid body, especially if you want stiffness, and there are a lot of trade-offs and subtleties. And there is just no perfect algorithm. The one thing I want you to take away, if you take away a single thing from this, is that stiffness is an incredibly important problem. If you're thinking about licensing a physics simulator, make sure you test it with things that move as fast and are as responsive as you want. Don't just look at the demo of all the kind of boxes dropping and Drupal-y and like, groovy, I can stack up 10 boxes and they kind of slowly do this. Make it run as fast as you want your game to run, meaning fast, not performance, but fast meaning responsiveness. Dave's technique of generalized coordinates with implicit integration is the best bet so far that I've found and that he's found. For authoring time, augmented is really nice because, hey, you just snap a bunch of stuff together like Tinker Toys. I think that working with an adaptive time-step integrator will actually prove, a tuned for games adaptive time-step integrator as the mysterious fifth simulator will actually prove to be the better thing if anyone gets the time to work on it. But we'll see. All right, I'll put the slides on my page, and that's the end of my talk. Thanks.